Well, wonderful. Welcome to the LSE. It's a pleasure to see you all here, and welcome to the first lecture in this year's LSE and Imperial College London Science and Society Public Lectures. Now, LSE and Imperial College London have been formally collaborating for some time, and this lecture series really is a continuation of our work on science and society. Now, the past lecture series that we've had together have focused on such things as risk and society, is science dangerous, who says our food is safe, new genetics and society, and science and the media. This year, as you probably have already gathered, we're going to be looking at environmental science and policy. Now, environmental issues continue to be very prominent on the policy agenda at local, national, and international levels. They're central to concerns about quality of life and integral to the pursuit of sustainable development. Yet, despite a huge range of policy initiatives in this area, trying to resolve environmental problems and so on, substantial dilemmas remain concerning how to implement environmental policy successfully and how to establish the conditions for environmental governance. So taking these kinds of issues as a focus, this series of public lectures is going to bring together expertise from the two colleges. On the one hand, the LSE's Centre for Environmental Policy and Governance, and on the other, Imperial College London's Environmental Policy and Management Group. And we're going to debate the progress within the overall range of the environmental agenda and environmental policies. But before I welcome our speaker tonight and various guests, I would like to thank, first of all, everyone who's put in so many hours planning and pulling together this lecture series. I'm very aware of all the hard work involved and on the amazing problem that seems to be in communicating between one bit of London and another in order to get the LSE and Imperial together. It's truly an international exercise, almost. But I'd very much like to thank here at the LSE, Yvonne Ryden, Andy Goulson, and Jenny Chu, as well as Salome van Jaarsveld, who've been doing the work here, and at Imperial, Tim Foxen, Peter Pearson, and Amanda Cherney. So thank you for that. And I'd also like to extend a very warm welcome tonight to Professor Chris Hankin, who's the pro-director of Imperial, and he and I are counterparts in that we both have responsibility for research in our respective and august institutions. Welcome also to everyone, staff and students of Imperial and the LSE. We're very pleased that we're all here together. And last of all, I would very much like to mention and to welcome our speaker for tonight, Simon Zadek, who's sitting here. Thank you, Simon, very much for coming and inaugurating this event. We are thrilled to have him here. For many of you will know that Dr. Simon Zadek is the co-founder and chair of the Institute of Social and Ethical Accountability, and that Dr. Zadek has done work on corporate responsibility and accountability as a practitioner, as an advisor, and as an external verifier. He served on numerous boards and advisory councils, including the Global Alliance for Workers and Communities, the State of the World's Commission for Globalization, and the ILO's World Commission on the Social Dimensions of Globalization. He's a senior fellow at Harvard, and in 2003 was named one of the World Economic Forum's Global Leaders for Tomorrow. And he's written, edited, and co-edited several books, including Responsible Competitiveness, Building Corporate Accountability with Peter Prezan and Richard Evans, and more recently, Tomorrow's History, which was published in 2004. And this text, which is a collection of his writings, discusses how corporate responsibility can be integrated into core business strategy. And it's on this theme that he's going to speak to us tonight. So please, Simon, welcome.
Thank you. There's always this dreaded moment during the introduction where you think, oh my God, they thought I was going to speak on something else. And as you've talked about environment and governance, I kept thinking, no, I don't know anything about that. But it kind of landed eventually in the right place. So thanks very much to those of you who've invited me here. Yvonne, particularly, thanks very much to you. As we were walking down here in the rain, I was reminding you that I think it was in 1997 when I was working at the New Economics Foundation, that the LSE and the New Economics Foundation put together a proposed, I can't even remember if it was a program of seminars here on corporate responsibility. And we spent ages doing this, and I remember got some little grant from the LSE, which at the time for the New Economics Foundation was really very useful. And nobody signed up. Nobody was interested. It never happened. And this was just back in 1997, and it's kind of interesting, not just that all you lot are here, which is really great, but it's sort of interesting how much has changed. And I'm going to pick up the story not kind of 5-10 years back, but more or less where I think we are today, and maybe a little bit about where I think we may be going over the next few years. But for those of you who are interested, we might want to come back to it in questions, or for those of you who are interested, it's just worthwhile reflecting, for those of you particularly who were here listening to Anita Roddick last night, that at the beginning of 1996, Body Shop produced its first values report, you know, which, as far as I'm concerned, in contemporary time, was the world's first sustainability report coming out of the corporate community. That was just 8 years ago, and it was incredibly long, totally unreadable, which was fine, because nobody really wanted to read it. They were just amazed that it was there. But 8 years later, you know, despite almost every corporate manager and CEO and business editor that I can remember from the media standing up after the publication of Body Shop's report and going, that's a Body Shop thing. Nothing else is going to happen here. It's a little bit like people talking about there'll be one or two telephones in 2004. An enormous amount has happened. And so what I'm going to try and share with you is a little bit coming out of that history of enormous change over the past 8 years in some areas, and all sorts of things that haven't really changed at all. And we've got to try and unpack why some things are moving along quite quickly and why other things aren't. 2 minutes on accountability, although I've put a little bit of material over there on that table for those of you who are interested. We're a non-profit organization created more or less 10 years ago and created by a group of NGOs and businesses and research organizations with a kind of a vision in the mid-90s, much as I just described to you, that what was kind of weird and wacky and offbeat and unusual and exceptional in the mid-90s, we all thought was going to be far more mainstreamed and therefore far more problematic by the middle of this decade, so more or less now. That our vision for accountability was that it was there to deal with the mainstreaming of the issue of business in society, there to deal with what actually happens as you move from the exceptional and extraordinary to the norm and the mundane. How do you deal with standards? How do you deal with regulation? How do you deal with the rump of the business community and the way it deals with responsibility issues rather than the exception, weirdo, oddball, which in some ways is much easier to understand and work with? And so we're a combination, a hybrid, if you like, of a standards organization. We do a whole bunch of research, which you can certainly see on our website. Increasingly engaged in public policy, which, again, is a sort of new space for at least some of these corporate responsibility issues. And constructed as a professional institute, we do a whole bunch of training and certification of individuals' competences. And although we're set up in the UK, we have a very august council of individuals and organizations that, in a way, reflect, at least in a limited degree, some of the extraordinary things that have happened not here in the UK, but that are happening elsewhere. Corporate responsibility in many shapes and forms are flourishing here, in some shapes and forms. But when you look at what's happening in India, in South Africa, in Brazil, in many ways it's far more extraordinary. More extraordinary because the problems there in many ways are far more penetrating. But there's real extraordinary political energy, and we're really pleased that many of the organizations that have led, in a sense, the movement, because it is a movement, sit on our council and offer us guidance. So that's, if you like, just a moment of accountability, because it also says something about where we've come from. I wanted to set out an agenda, and I'm going to just lighten this up a little bit, so to speak, of just five different pieces in the domain of corporate responsibility, and in some ways what extends beyond it, that it seems to us sitting at Accountability and myself are in the process of change, are the core, if you like, tipping points of things that we're trying to understand what to do with and how to move forward. And I'm going to come back to two or three of these in a little bit more detail as I run through this presentation. But the kind of short version of the five, which is pretty obvious, is how do you move in looking at business to understanding how responsible business practices work to a point where you understand how it feeds the core of the business, and in particular, how it relates to business strategy itself. Secondly, how do you move from an interesting but very marginalized social responsible investment movement to understand how social and environmental issues can really become mainstream within the core of the investment community? And three, over the past 10 years, we've seen probably hundreds of different social and environmental standards emerging around different aspects of corporate performance. What's going to happen? It's sort of, at the moment, almost untenable with the number of different initiatives, codes, standards, guidelines, management systems, all in the voluntary space, plus a whole lot of new stuff emerging in the regulatory space. Where might this go? Do we imagine a sort of global standards architecture beginning to come out of this morass, kind of chaos of innovation, which has been so amazing over the past few years? And somewhere, and I'll come back to this more or less halfway through my chat, we have to think beyond what is happening at the micro level. And I'm sure all of you do that in all sorts of different ways, but it is very notable that most people working in the corporate responsibility space have spent much, if not all, of their time focusing exclusively on what individual companies or micro-level changes look like, and have made very few connections to some of the broader debates about trade policy, competition policy, investment policy. In other words, where do all these kind of corporate responsibility bits and pieces fits into just changes in the rules, changes in the way in which the structure of markets actually function? And somewhere you get to this top end of the story, which is the governance piece, and we were briefly talking about governance just before we started. And of course, corporate governance is a big subject, and there's lots of interesting connections between corporate responsibility and corporate governance. But what happens when you take it just a notch higher and you begin to think about the links between what's happening in this corporate responsibility space and how it relates to global governance, regional governance, local governance? In other words, the governance of much larger systems than individuals or collectives of businesses themselves. And we begin to see all sorts of connections between corporate responsibility and emerging new governance systems that go beyond business itself, which is both kind of interesting and in some ways confusing. So a quick agenda, and what I want to do is just to drill down on a few of those bits to give a kind of a taster, I guess, as to how at least I look at some of this stuff and others who work with me. Firstly, I don't want to spend a lot of time on the so-called business case for corporate responsibility, but there are a couple of points that need to be said that will course through my comments. The first is it's helpful just to distinguish very simply between a kind of a business case that more or less runs along a sort of cost-benefit type way of thinking. You know, if you're kind of nice to your employees, then they kind of treat you well and they don't leave so quickly and they work a bit harder and they don't take such long lunch hours. Or if you're kind of nice to NGOs, then they're not so aggressive towards you and, you know, they'll come and spend time with you and help you understand about climate change. And, you know, these are all kind of real but quite localized, quite low level, and have very little to do with where the business is really going, yeah, which doesn't make them unimportant, but it also doesn't make them really at the heart of where business runs. So when you think about, just think of some examples, you know, when BP talks about beyond petroleum, or when GlaxoSmithKline talks about health, not drugs, or when Ford Motor Corporation talks about mobility, not cars, you know, one's got to smile a little bit and maybe not even smile, but kind of grimace. But to be purely cynical is foolish, because part of it is schmaltz and nothing else. And part of it is actually the beginnings of an imagination about what a next generation of business models are actually going to look like. Yeah, and so if one stands back from one slightly cynical, weathered, urban existence and try and think about where some of these sectors are likely to evolve, one begins to see this kind of second generation business case beginning to emerge, where some of the more innovative, enterprising, extraordinary risk-taking companies are thinking beyond the functionality of their historical business process, products and services, and trying to reach out in their minds and also, to some extent, in their practices to imagine what it might mean to really take some of the social and environmental challenges we're facing today and to build new businesses around them. Let's not fool ourselves. It's not easy. Just today, I was on a conference call with a group of senior managers from a pharmaceutical company who've spent 2.5 years and a great deal of money trying to understand how to build a business model out of doing prevention in diabetes. It's quite easy with an individual, you know, particularly if you're talking about type 2 diabetes, you know, run around more, don't eat crap, don't drink too much. You know, there's some fairly simple things that help you avoid type 2 emerging at least as fast as it might otherwise. But try doing it for 150 million people and work out a business model to make it function. And after 2.5 years, what they were telling me on the phone was they'd given up. You know, they simply can't work out how to build a business model around it. And so this isn't about people or institutions not wanting to do it. It's often about the fact that it's very, very hard. Last year, we launched our own rating of, in this case, the Global 100, which is the world's largest companies by revenue. By revenue? Yes, by revenue. And what we were trying to do was not measure how good they were at doing social stuff or environmental stuff. What we were trying to do was, as it kind of says on the bottom of the page, was to understand how one can measure the degree of integration of this social and environmental stuff in the way in which they do business. And it's clearly not simple, particularly when it's cross-sectoral with a limited amount of information, but we picked out 6 different domains, as you can see on the page, and worked through at least one set of metrics that would help us understand a little bit about these top 100 companies. The results the first time round were, you know, there were some who seemed to be doing pretty good, some of them perhaps fairly obvious, some of them a little less obvious, and there were some that were doing remarkably bad, many of which actually I'd never even heard of before. But what was clear when we looked at the data was that overall, really, the G100 were doing rather bad. And when you looked at the sectoral differences, a whole lot of interesting factors began to emerge. Obviously, there are sector leaders, you know, maybe the BPs, maybe the Unilevers, maybe the Novo Nordisks in pharmaceuticals. You know, we can think of quite extraordinary companies in individual sectors. But when you look at sectors overall, you begin to see patterns which don't just describe what individual companies are able to do, but begins to help one understand what some of the structural, sectoral constraints are to really advancing some of this stuff. And then taking the same way of looking at it and framing the question slightly differently, we recently ran a survey with across 500 managers of a global American chemicals company. And we asked them a whole bunch of questions, one of which looked roughly like this. This wasn't quite the words we used. But more or less we asked, you know, do you think any of this stuff can really help you run your business and drive business success in traditional ways as well as non-traditional ways? And as you can see from the kind of red over on your right, the answer was overwhelmingly yes. And then we asked them, well, what really is the main problem? And for those of you who can kind of shift slightly to your left, what basically came through was, in a way, you know, a representation of the entire thing in one simple chart. That yes, you know, many, many business managers believe that social and environmental responsibility makes sense in a long-term business model, and understanding how to integrate them in order to meet societal expectations, advantages, disadvantages, risk management, all the usual stuff, it kind of works. But when you really look at what's driving them, the short-term financial targets that most companies are facing, particularly, obviously, publicly traded, but also many other companies in many other contexts, represents for them the single greatest constraint to advancing exactly that long-term potential. And so one begins to see, again, some of the structural dynamics within the market that raise some of the problems for advancing responsibility, at least in some respects. A piece of work that we launched at the World Economic Forum in Davos just a few weeks ago entitled Mainstreaming Responsible Investment. And the question we asked was, how can you mainstream this stuff into not what the SRI niche players do, not the negative screening that puts you off tobacco or booze or drugs or something else that you happen not to like, but in the way actually the main rump of the financial community does its day-to-day investment and trading. And the report is voluminous, and you're welcome to download it from our website. But the single quote that I put up there, whilst not summarizing everything, in a sense, makes the same point that those 500 managers from that global chemicals company also makes, which is, in the long term, there are all kinds of things that we could and should be doing, but even if you just forget about the social and environmental stuff and just concentrate on financial success, actually, short-termism in the investment market is driving us to miss all kinds of financial opportunities, even before you get to the non-financial stuff that the corporate responsibility agenda speaks to and encourages one to take into account. It was interesting that, you know, moving around and beginning to look at what was going on, certainly we saw two major changes sitting, growing out there. One, in a sense, captured by Al Gore's quote at the top, was we begin to see a new generation of fund management companies thinking differently about how they invest, demanding different mandates from pension funds, mutual funds, insurance companies, and other sources of capital that allow them to invest long. And as a result, not because they are dedicated to dealing with social and environmental issues, but because they're investing long, they find it makes far more sense to understand far more about the social and environmental characteristics of business performance today and going forward. And then Patricia Hewitt's quote down the bottom, if you like, captures the political side of the same equation, which is the changing structure of ownership, the changing demographics that not all but many countries are facing around the world today, all create a very different kind of political imperative that pushes back against the investment community, demanding them to deal with social and environmental issues, again, not necessarily because someone's shouting about human rights, but because the real owners of capital, you, me, hopefully, at some point going forward, yeah, actually can see that if their fund managers are not dealing with this stuff, then the security of their future livelihoods is really in doubt. And so we begin to see within this responsible investment area, I think, a series of changes which can unpick certainly one, if not the major constraint to advancing corporate responsibility in the mainstream, dominant corporate community. Let me move on slightly, because there weren't two generations, but three generations. Because somewhere beyond that second generation, where one's thinking of business strategy, long-term investment, and so on, there's a sort of a bigger world, which has something to do with shifting the telescope round from not can you make money out of doing good, or some slightly vulgar version of that, but when you add it all up, does it really make any difference? Very simple questions. What does it take if you think of a Nike and a Gap and a Levi's and a Liz Claiborne and a Sara Lee and half a dozen other kind of funky premium brands all doing nice things to workers in their global supply chains? Add up all the people. It's quite a lot of people. You're probably talking 20 million plus families. So it's really a bunch of people. But it's actually just a drop in the ocean. These are the aristocracy of the developing world. You know, we're talking about a tiny drop in the ocean of people who, relatively speaking, are better off already. And so somewhere we need to ask the question, how does this actually change the big picture? Or does it? Or doesn't it? You know, is it something that's good and we should push, but really is only just a piece of the story? Yeah, because actually, if it's just a piece of the story, fine, we can spend some time on it, because it does seem to help some people and some situations, but we shouldn't expect that it really can have or should have a transformative effect on the way in which we understand business in society. So somewhere you've got to ask that question, even if it's really confusing and at times somewhat despairing. And I guess there are two or three bits to the answer. Many people, certainly within civil society space, you know, responds to this question of the large picture with one simple word, you know, standards, laws, regulations, level the playing field, make them do it. You know, this voluntary stuff really ain't going to go very far at all. And it certainly does seem to me that out of an enormous amount of kind of voluntary, chaotic standards development, we're beginning to see some semblance of order. That somewhere there's a set of normative frameworks that are emerging, I would say broadly in kind of UN space. And obviously they kind of manifest in many different ways, whether it's the OECD guidelines, the UN Global Compact's 10 principles, you know, whether it turns up in conventions and tripartite agreements and all sorts of bits and pieces. But there's a sort of universal values space which we can debate and needs to be constantly checked and probed and negotiated, but is increasingly prefiguring most of these corporate responsibility standards in one shape or form. And then kind of a level down was the bit that accountability was originally created for, which is, you know, replace gap. You know, it sounds such an odd thing to be a plumber or an architect, but you know, if the generally accepted accounting principles can't count properly, then actually it's really hard for anything else to shift properly. That if consistently one is misinformed and misunderstanding how value is or could be created, yeah, it seems such like a sort of a simple thing, and yet it's profoundly difficult to shift. And the good news is that 10 years of work, we begin to see new models of reporting, new models of accounting, new models of auditing beginning to emerge. To some extent, emerging in a sort of separate space from financial accounting, auditing, and reporting, but beginning to kind of explore how these different systems, non-financial accounting and financial accounting, begin to talk to each other. The Global Reporting Initiative, Accountability's own A1000 assurance stuff, these are all bits of kit that are beginning to become norms and are beginning to influence the mainstream understanding of what generally accepted accounting principles, auditing, assurance principles, and reporting are going to look like in the future. And then way down here, and I'm not going to go into it in any detail at all, there's a kind of another whole scene going on, the development of new kinds of management systems, some of which are integrative, i.e. crossing over many different functions, and some of which are specialized, dealing with labor standards, dealing with transparency issues, dealing with carbon emissions. And there is some order beginning to emerge, which actually is kind of slightly surprising for most of us, and yet true. These are the bits that I've referred to already. But the standards piece, it certainly seems to me, is only one piece of the story. We function within a world that runs markets, and markets requires us to understand all sorts of things about productivity and competitiveness, and whilst constructing a whole bunch of rules around reporting or a whole bunch of codes around compliance, that in itself alone doesn't do the job. That somewhere we need to understand a slightly different question and how to address it, which is when we understand how larger scale markets begin to evolve, not just what individual companies do, when we begin to understand how regional competitiveness policy, national competitiveness policy, the way in which governments and international organizations frame the terms on which competitiveness takes place, then we're kind of heading up towards that third generation, which goes beyond what the individual company is doing and begins to explore the linkages between the micro and the macro in a serious way. And the cost of getting this wrong is quite serious. And I've offered three actually very real examples, although also very different examples. Work we're doing in South Africa, both with the South African government and also a group of pretty progressive companies, is exploring, you know, a very, very tricky problem, which is the black economic empowerment agenda post-apartheid is clearly a crucial part of South Africa's political and economic development. And yet, certainly the international investment community and many international corporations are of the view that it introduces significant competitive disadvantages into the South African economy. So it's being used as a way in which to explain why inward investment isn't happening. It's being used to explain why costs have increased. It's being used to explain why enough new jobs are not being created in the South African economy. And there's a kind of question on the table, obviously, is it true, isn't it, which is a sort of a fact-finding exercise. But there's also a very different kind of question, which is not is it or isn't it true, as if it's somehow lying in the road waiting to be discovered, but how can one make and ensure that the black economic empowerment agenda doesn't actually do South Africa significant harm through simply another door, through creating economic dysfunctions that in the long term one hopes will be washed out by the growing number of empowered people who bring new skills into the labor market, into the financial markets, and into the market for innovation and growth. But in the short term, can be disabling if it really does have those negative effects that particularly international financial capital argues that it does. And so somewhere, at some point, senior people within the South African government turn around, not just to me, but to many other people, and go, don't tell me about this corporate responsibility stuff. Yeah, I'm not interested, because the moment you walk out the door, I'm going to have Goldman Sachs in here telling me that all this corporate responsibility stuff is a problem. Yeah, I'm going to have the IMF telling me that actually I can't pass equal opportunities legislation in this country in the way that I want to. Yeah, this doesn't make sense. So either you show me how corporate responsibility can be more closely aligned to the way in which we can compete in international markets, or to be honest, I don't really want to talk to you. And I think that's a kind of a fair enough comment, and a comment that one hears repeated not just in Cambodia, but in China, in Brazil, in India, and in many other countries, that this stuff has to fit with the pragmatic realities of emerging economies trying to function in complex and often unfair international markets. And that's a challenge for us, not only for someone out there to resolve. And the good news is that there's the beginnings of really quite a lot of work in this space. A whole group of organizations came together now, it must be about 2 years ago, hosted by Accountability, looking at this kind of slightly peculiar question, where you've got a whole bunch of people working on corporate responsibility that know absolutely squat about international competitiveness. And then you've got a whole lot of people working on international competitiveness, doing lots of ratings and the WEFs and the IMDs and all these people who, with a few exceptions, really know absolutely nothing about corporate responsibility. Actually, most of them know actually nothing about corporate strategy, let alone corporate responsibility. And so you've got these completely different knowledge communities really not communicating with each other. And in the middle, you've got people doing things like competition policy that really don't know anything about either side. So there's a whole architecture of knowledge that's very kind of broken up, not really functioning. And the policy space is kind of waiting to be created. And our piece, as always, Accountabilities, is to kind of try and seed the conversation, yeah, to kind of show that it's an interesting place to work in and look at. And that's what we've been trying to do through a series of publications, through a convening that we're doing with the UN in various parts of the world, looking at the subject, very, very specific pieces of this equation. And it turns out that it's kind of quite interesting. And I just give you a couple of very brief examples to illustrate the point. The end of the multi-fiber arrangement. I'm sure some of you, if not all of you, will know a little, if not a lot, about that. Potential implications for a number of different countries that have historically arguably survived as sources of textiles and apparel into Europe and North America by virtue of the existence of quotas, all very disputable and confusing issues, with kind of China being the great wolf eating up a lot of the sourcing opportunities. Actually, it turns out, not primarily because they're cheaper, but just because they have better business processes. But there's a whole lot of stuff out there. Cambodia, really interesting case at this point in time. They can see they're at a severe cost disadvantage compared to China. And so they asked themselves a question. They said, actually, if we pull together the trade union movement, the government of Cambodia, international agencies like the World Bank, the brands, the Nikes and Gaps, and the sourcing companies, which are often, in fact, from Taiwan, but also some from Cambodia, located in Cambodia, can we cut a deal? Can we cut a deal about labor standards? That if we can work on it systemically, not factory by factory, if we can absolutely secure labor standards in relation to the kinds of codes of conduct linked to ILO conventions that all the premium brands have now signed up to, is that actually enough of an edge? It's a non-price competitive advantage that can hold our own against China. So just 4 days ago was the completion of the negotiations in Cambodia for a second whole round of work where the premium brands have signed up to, I think it's either a 2 or 3 year period of time where they work with their sourcing factories, with the international trade union movement, with the Cambodian government, a number of international organizations to try and consolidate this non-price advantage and to consolidate Cambodia as a kind of a labor standards haven. Yeah, so it's very real. It speaks to thousands, if not millions, of jobs just in that single sector. And one could continue by talking through Chile and London and a number of other cases, and maybe we can come back to that in questions. Inevitably, we were asked, can you measure it, this responsible competitiveness stuff? And so we gave it a bash. The end of 2004, we launched the first responsible competitiveness index. There's some information about it over there, but the short version is we took 51 countries for which we could pull together at least some data. We constructed a variable for the state of corporate responsibility in that country using 11 different data sets. We took that variable and stuck it back into the World Economic Forum competitiveness ratings and re-ran all the data, all the econometrics, in order to see whether that additional variable made a difference. Did it make a difference to the way in which all the numbers played themselves out? And if so, what kind of difference? And the simple answer was that the statistics suggested that it made a difference, that when you build in a variable for corporate responsibility at some macro level, you begin to see at least the suggestion that it can impact on national competitiveness. The slightly more complicated answer inevitably looks like this, which was the data was just unbelievably bad. The econometrics was very, very suspect. And so the results really can't be trusted at all. But the interesting thing really is the subject. In other words, by putting together this index and by putting it out there, what's happened, of course, not surprisingly, is suddenly many countries, many companies, large companies, and many different organizations working around competitiveness are beginning to cluster around this question. Where does corporate responsibility fit into competitiveness, not just at the illustrative level, particular environmental regulations, particular sectors that have dynamism, wind, or something else, but at a more structural level? And now there's an enormous amount of work going on through the UN and elsewhere beginning to try and make more sense of some of this data and some of the links between the micro and the macro. I have sort of one more piece of this story to share with you. And it sort of looks or starts a little bit like this, which is it's sort of okay to talk about what's happened or what might happen, but it gets to be really hard to understand how it happens. That when you look at most of the material that's written on any of the subjects I've just talked about, that they give you sort of pictures. You know, this is how much money is invested in that. These companies are doing this. But when you ask, well, how did they get from A to B? You know, what are the pathways of change, which in many ways are the most interesting and most difficult set of questions, not only intellectually, but from a policy practitioner point of view, then everybody goes into a kind of a coma. And so we've spent some time trying to understand how change happens. You know, what happens if individual companies make moves? How do they drive other companies? The straight sort of market leaders, followers type models. You know, at what point does collaboration between business and government agencies tend to push down social and environmental standards. At what point does it push up social and environmental standards? Subjects, I'm sure, that have been looked at by many of you in specific contexts here. And I just wanted to share a couple of thoughts on this at a very almost simplistic level. What we see when we look at most subjects in the corporate responsibility space, it's sort of something like this. You know, whether you think about carbon emissions, whether you think about obesity, whether you think about the price of HIV/AIDS drugs, whether you think about labor standards, whether you think about transparency of the oil sector, you can almost take any of these themes and you can track over a period of time kind of this kind of learning tree, where what society comes to expect changes, somehow moving from a that's the way it is, people just eat too many hamburgers and get fat, through to business has got some kind of complicit role in this happening. It's not just a consumer choice problem, or corruption is not just kind of inherent in the genes of particular communities around the world. Gradually growing out into, actually, it's not just business. There's a whole bunch of players involved here that need to have some role in fixing the problem. And then what's going on within the business is a sort of similar sort of a thing. You know, so to begin with, they're in a state of complete denial. You know, we just sell hamburgers. You know, we just do Nike shoes. You know, we just do drugs. We just sell cigarettes. You know, whatever it happens to be. You know, they're all legal things to do. They're not breaking the law most of the time. Through a sort of yes, we can see that we're somehow part of the solution, but it can't really be done given the market, all the previous things that I've been talking about over the past 20 minutes, all the way out to the beginnings for some companies of, well, maybe there's an edge here. You know, when Sir John Brown goes, I think I'm going to disclose what we're paying to Angola on the royalties front. Yeah, he's sort of thinking, well, maybe actually there's an edge here. Through to, actually there isn't an edge here, and I'm being locked out of new drilling opportunities, so I think I'd better get everybody else to do it too. And so instead there's a kind of level the playing field requirement that sits out at the back. And then one kind of final piece, which sort of builds on it, is you get this sort of evolutionary sort of systemic model, organizational model of how companies think about this a lot of the time. A sort of denial piece, which I've already covered, then, you know, we'll do a code. Yeah, we'll do a code. It's okay. We've done a code. We don't do that stuff anymore. Through to beginning to think organizationally in a different way about how these different things need to be dealt with. Increasingly integrating it into business processes, and then increasingly integrating their understanding of the business into public policy processes. Yeah, so it, obviously this is a very simple, vulgar, crude way of looking at it, but it's actually not so far off the truth in quite a lot of cases. And if you put it together in a sort of completely, ridiculously simple way, you get something like this. And somewhere, you've got societal learning processes going on, yeah, which obviously are much more complex than the linear version that I'm describing. Yeah, and you've got organizational, business learning processes going on, trying to understand how to respond, but also obviously influence that social learning system that's happening in very different ways in different places. And if you wanted to look at this square as a business person, what you would see is a risk management tool. Yeah, so you would see, actually, you know, if kind of the maturity of the issue from a societal point of view has really matured considerably, then simply being in a defensive mode doesn't work at all. Yeah, and similarly, one can choose to kind of run ahead of the show. And what's quite interesting is that we've shared this, I mean, evolved it with, but also shared it with many companies. And although inevitably there are lots of complications to the way one might think about this, it actually works quite well. We mapped it with a number of different companies, and here's just a kind of a simple version that just plonks a few companies around the labor standards issues. And one can either take it as different companies doing different things, or you can look at it over time. You can play it really any which way you want. But just to illustrate the point, you know, in 1998, Levi Strauss launched its first terms of engagement, which was effectively a code of conduct around dealing with labour standards in global supply chains. And it was the first one. I mean, it was amazing. We all sat there gobsmacked and wondering what was going to happen next. And, you know, over the years, more and more companies have done the same, but actually doing the same now doesn't help at all. You know, Walmart has just adopted a code of conduct, but so what? You know, if they were living back in 1998, then sure, that would make all kinds of sense, and it would be as much a leadership role as Levi Strauss took at that time. But at this stage, it really makes very little difference at all. And so one can begin to look at different corporate strategies, understanding how they relate to each other, understanding which companies are taking a leadership role, and suddenly you realize that all of the stuff you've all learned about how companies do business and how they understand themselves in the market and how they deal with themselves as a leader or follower and how they have responsive tactics and all of that stuff holds true. Yeah, and it holds true in very, very complicated ways sometimes, but looking at this social and environmental stuff, we begin to see more and more companies dealing with it in actually quite classical ways, ways that they would also think about corporate strategy in many other contexts. And not surprisingly, we end up with something like this. And obviously, it's only an example, although actually we could talk about a number of different examples. But when Phil Knight, who until recently was the chair, founder, and CEO of the Nike Corporation, stood up in July 2000 at the United Nations and declared his support for a universal set of mandatory social audit standards that would require every company in the world to report on the way in which they deal with labor standards in a way that was comparable, everybody thought he was going mad. Yeah, actually, he wasn't going mad at all. He was being really smart. Yeah, they'd spent 10 years being in a class of one, 10 years being the poster child of globalization, or more correctly, the anti-globalization movement. They were spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year on trying to deal with labor standards. And actually, there was just enormous gain to getting everybody to be measured on the same basis. Because from their point of view, they were doing rather well. It's just that nobody would believe them. Yeah. And so we begin to see this happening more and more. We begin to see that circle coming around the corner of leadership companies calling for regulation in key and around key social and environmental issues. I won't go through this in any detail. It's actually not terribly detailed. But it's just to kind of point out that somewhere we think about corporate responsibility as being instead of compliance. Yeah. And one sees constantly this fierce and fairly pointless debate about should it be regulatory, hard law, or should it be soft law, voluntary, some sort of organic rule-based system. And actually, what we're seeing is that it's the wrong way of asking the question. What we're seeing is that the early stages of most of these issues is a high level of conflict and a high push towards statute regulation. Yeah, then gradually, as these partnerships begin to emerge in soft law, codes, voluntary standards, all of these collaborative initiatives, yeah, the call for statutory shifts collapses, yeah, as the level of conflict reduces. And then it sort of goes into reverse. And one begins to see those very same groups beginning to call for regulation. Just one final simple example. I was in New York about 10 days ago talking to a group of banks and the NGOs that have been campaigning against them about what's happening with the adoption of the Equator Principles. And a number of you may know the Equator Principles was launched, I don't know, 2-3 years ago. I can't remember now. And are a set of social and environmental codes, principles, processes around project investment, so cross-border investment, particularly into southern emerging developing countries. And 2 or 3 years on, all the NGOs are sitting there going, you're not proving that you're doing it properly, you're simply saying that you're doing it okay. And what the companies are going is, well, we think we are doing it okay, you're right, we're not auditing and disclosing in the way that you would want to, but actually we've got a different kind of problem. And our problem is that although today the banks that have signed up to the Equator Principles account for 75% of all cross-border project investment in the world, private that is, in 5 years' time, Chinese investment is going to grow to massive proportions, not only within China, but cross-border. So we're already heavily competing on whether the Chinese or us, ABN, Citibank, whoever it happens to be, is going to build that dam in Brazil, say. And none of those banks are signing up. And so they're sitting there going, you NGOs are actually calling for more rigor, and what we're facing is a competitive nightmare because we can't walk away from the Aquarius principles because of the brand connection. But at the same time, there's a whole bunch of players that you don't have any leverage over at all through campaigning who have no interest at all in signing up to the Aquarius principles. And so for ABN, it wasn't a big stretch, but for Citibank, because they sit in the US and they don't think that way, it came as a great shock to them. But at the end of the day, they realized that what they should really do is join with Friends of the Earth to call for global regulation. And it really did come as a shock. I mean, it was a shock to me that it was a shock to them, but it sort of follows in that way, that they could see that actually that was the only way out, that they were going to have to start moving now on a regulatory agenda around the Aquarius principles if they were not going to be in serious trouble. Very curious. So, I'm going to not go through this, but just flick to the end. Because I think I've really covered more than any of us could reasonably handle in one sitting. What I've tried to do is kind of scan fast what I think are some of the issues. What I've tried to do is offer you at least my language, which is neither an exotic, idealistic language, nor is a cynical, embittered language. And I've tried to give you a sense of what some of the dynamics are that are not simply part of what one finds if one does a piece of research, but also part of the things that I think are at the forefront of change over the next 5 or 10 years. I hope you find it kind of vaguely interesting, otherwise it will have been a bit of a waste of time, and I'm happy to take questions if you like. Thank you.
Thank you, Yvonne, and thank you, Simon, for, as usual, a succinct but very thorough overview of what is an extremely complex area. And in responding, I just wanted to give a few reflections from the business perspective, because that's actually where I spent most of my career in business. The last 9 years have been spent at Imperial, and I'm almost regarded as an academic, I think, not quite. So I'll perhaps bring it back to reflect on what I think some of these issues mean for us in academia. But as I reflect on the current activity of CSR within business, I can't help but think that we're following a similar pattern that we did with the development of environmental management processes in businesses sort of 10, 15 years ago. They're being developed by specialist departments. John Elkington calls it the silo principle, where they are completely divorced from the mainstream business, beavering away, often very enthusiastically, often a lot of our ex-graduates from the particular course that I run at Imperial, which is an MSc course on business and environment, business and sustainability management. But these activities take place somewhat apart from the mainstream business activity for most of the companies that we have interactions with anyway. The activities are not fully integrated into mainstream business. They don't influence a mainstream business. Often the people actually don't communicate between the CSR departments and, for example, the marketing department, would you believe? Although as a marketing person myself, I would consider that every function of business should be a function of marketing, but then perhaps I'm biased. But they don't even speak the same language. And I have to tell you, this is very frustrating for some of our ex-graduates who've gone into these CSR-type jobs within businesses. And this is taking place even though there are huge resources being pushed into the development of environmental reports, corporate social responsibility reports, even spawning a vast industry, and you know why not, of consultants that some of our ex-graduates are occupied in, vast industries, rating agencies, benchmarking, and so on. Companies are winning prizes for their reports, prizes and awards, but is it really making a difference? Now, that's the measure that I always ask of anything like this. Of course, the activity behind environmental reporting, social responsibility reporting, and so on, is absolutely vital. In other words, the gathering of vast amounts of information. Companies should be doing that anyway. That's just part of the practice of management, having good data behind on which to take business decisions. But you have to ask the question, who reads all these reports? And talking to some companies recently, by far the greatest majority of people who request their environmental and corporate social responsibility reports are students. Well, why not? One wonders if that's actually who they're intended for. Students, academics, maybe some of the awards and panels and so on. They're often engaged in tick box activities, often keeping up with their competitors. That's another audience that reads these corporate environmental and corporate social responsibility reports, are other competitors who want to see that what's the new thing that's been included in the report this time, we better put it in next time. Sounds a bit cynical, I know. It's very frustrating, I have to tell you, for those of us who are helping develop the managers of tomorrow, the sustainability managers, if you like, that somehow this is not yet seen as part of mainstream management. And I think the challenge for some of our students is who are taking these somewhat specialist courses. I don't think we're producing specialists. I always say we're trying to produce true generalists, but they are somewhat specialist courses as they go forward into their future careers in business organizations, is how can they achieve integration of these activities, the kind of things that Simon's been talking about tonight, how can they achieve the integration of these into mainstream business activities so that businesses achieve maximum advantage from those activities? And I think only when corporate social responsibility programs are part of mainstream business, once they're part of the culture of the organization, once they're part of the actual brand of the organization, will we truly be successful in changing the way that we do business. So I think there are two challenges, and if I bring it back to academia, there are two challenges that I think we face, including those of us who, as I say, are helping to develop the managers of tomorrow. First of all, I think we need to expand the development of the sort of metrics, and Simon alluded to some of them, the sort of metrics, financial indicators, which would persuade mainstream business people that there really is a case for adopting a lot of these practices and for pursuing sustainability issues. And that these are communicated, these metrics, these indicators are communicated to mainstream business people in language that they would understand. I think that's the other problem that we face. A lot of this is, I would hesitate to say jargon, but it certainly has its own language. I think the second challenge for academia is to ensure that we widen the teaching activity beyond these specialist environmental sustainability courses so that all graduates from all courses, from all disciplines, are sensitized to the issues of sustainability, whether they are engineers, scientists, computer specialists, if you don't mind me saying so, Chris, who will each understand their own individual roles, responsibilities in achieving the long-term goals of sustainability within business functions, if that's where they're going to spend their careers, whether they're in R&D, production, sales, marketing, human resources, whatever function. And especially general management. And I think here we have to target our MBA courses to make sure that sustainability issues are embedded within MBA courses. And I have to say, there's not a great deal of evidence that that's happening. It really doesn't seem to be on their radar screens. So that these are not strange issues for these MBA graduates when they go into companies. The companies have not got to start from scratch and educate them into the issues that they actually very often want to take on board, at least they certainly do at the senior levels. And so that even our graduates from special courses who are going into CSR functions initially at least are not banging their heads against brick walls, but the people they're interacting with throughout the company understand the language and are prepared to move forward together to embed these issues firmly into mainstream business management. Because I have to say, if not, then we're destined to go join the dinosaurs. Although this time we probably can't blame some single catastrophic act, it'll just be our own short-sighted stupidity. Now, I don't want to end on that kind of somewhat negative point. There are some positive signs, some very positive signs, particularly on the other side of the pond, in North America, in USA and Canada. You probably know of the WRI, the World Resources Institute's Beyond Grey Pinstripes initiative, which seeks to rank North American MBA courses and institutions according to their sustainability credentials, and we know that students are choosing courses and institutions based on those rankings. Here in Europe, I think the move is afoot, and I think it will be student-led, and again, why not? I'm fortunate to have been invited to the International Advisory Board for the student organization Oikos, which is an international sustainability business students for sustainability organization. And they've currently produced a toolkit which enable their students to, let's say, interact, or you might want to say pressure, their existing course directors into incorporating sustainability issues into the existing courses. I think it's going to go further than that. There's a move perhaps to do exactly the same benchmarking exercise in Europe, to benchmark, to rate, particularly initially MBA courses, in their sustainability credentials, and I think that has to be welcomed. Students in future will be choosing, I hope, from these kind of rating exercises. And what's more important, employers will be selecting graduates from these courses that have known to, high sustainability credentials. All I can say is, watch this space. We better be prepared for it. Thank you.
Well, I thought I'd offer some brief comments to leave time for questions, both on Simon's presentation and on one of the questions raised by Andrew, namely whether this makes any difference. For the last year or so, I've been working with a socially responsible investment firm to address exactly this issue. And this project has been based on the recognition that the CSR world has been dominated by the adoption of all sorts of policies and procedures. While there are all sorts of rating schemes to compare corporate performance on whether they have these in place, there are major issues then about whether all of this activity trickles through into actual changes in the performance of companies in different places in the world. We've been trying to evaluate this, and it's been quite complicated because the corporate reports that are published make it almost impossible to compare performance of companies on social or environmental grounds. Fortunately, some government data exists in a common format which enables us to do this, and the project has found it's focused on oil refineries in particular. The project has found that there are massive variations in corporate performance. For example, oil refineries in Europe emit 2.5 times as much as oil refineries in North America. So there are major issues about globalization and the diffusion of global norms and standards and so on. We've also found, interestingly though, that oil refineries seem to emit more in poorer areas. So in some ways that where the refinery is located in an area with lower income, with lower levels of employment, also in lower or less densely populated areas, that emissions tend to be higher. So we found that despite regulation, despite CSR initiatives and so on, that there are major issues about exactly what constitutes social responsibility in different settings. This raises huge issues about corporate accountability, I think, partly because, as we said earlier, the reports don't seem to provide much useful information to be able to compare the behavior of different companies in different locations in the world, but also because there are issues about how corporations are governed. The normal interpretation, which Simon raised and talked about, is that corporate governance relates to the structures within firms, the relationships between owners and managers and staff, for example. But there's a broader interpretation of corporate governance, which is something that various people here at LSE are working on, which is that corporations are governed by a series of external actors. Now, most classically, this is government, and again, Simon talked about the role of government regulation. But there are other forms of governance, market governance, for example, where, for example, investors or insurers or trading partners regulate, in a private sense, the activities of businesses through supply chains, for example, to encourage them or enforce some increase in the level of standards on the different dimensions of CSR. There are also big issues then about civic regulation, about non-state regulation by NGOs, for example. And here again, we're seeing the emergence and evolution of all sorts of new forms of civic regulation. These come in the shape of, you know, good neighbor agreements, for example, where community groups engage directly with firms to regulate them in different forms. And this is an area where practice is way ahead of the theory, I think, in terms of our ability to understand the capacity of different social groups to govern business, or our ability to understand the capacity of different market actors to govern the behavior and also the performance of corporations. So I think this is a really interesting area. As Simon said, it's evolving incredibly rapidly, and it's difficult to keep up with many of the key dimensions of it. Here at LSE, our Center for Environmental Policy and Governance will be focusing on these issues over the years to come, and they're already a key part of our MSc programs on environment. I know that there are different aspects of CSR which are also being addressed by different actors in the LSE and also in Imperial, and we look forward to collaborating more with those actors in the future.
Thank you. I'm Richard McVie. I'm one of the professors of accounting at LSE, and it may comfort Adrian to know that all of our third year accounting and finance undergraduates do a module in corporate social responsibility reporting. The particular thing I wanted to pick up, there are a whole range of issues that Simon raised about the way in which accounting numbers might influence or not influence business decisions, and this is a fairly contentious area of research and practice. But the one particular thing I thought it might be worth discussing is a lot of this has been voluntary in the past. A lot of it, therefore, is highly varied, a whole raft of confusing alternatives about what reporting should consist of. And then this big question is, does the reporting actually change the behaviour? And I wonder whether you have any comment on the fact that kind of the movement's been, as you said, from compliance to business performance. But in some senses, it's going to come back to compliance because there are now initiatives, particularly in the European Union, particularly in the United Kingdom, with the introduction of what they're calling the Operating and Financial Review, which is going to be mandatory from next year for companies to report on employee, community, and environmental aspects of their business strategy and performance. Is that going to be a good thing, or as some people predict, is that just going to take away what's good and turn it into boilerplate, legalistic reporting?
Yeah, so operating and financial reviews. There are two different trends going on in the non-financial reporting area internationally. One is what I would call broadband reporting, yeah, which is pre-specification of metrics and topics. You know, you report on how many children in your supply chain, you report on how many buckets of water you chucked out yesterday. So that's very compliance, very tick box, very end of pipeline performance, and almost nothing to do with business strategy. Almost unusable data for anybody outside the organization or inside the organization. So lots of data, not very helpful, is what we're finding in practice. And those who have been most vocal in demanding that information are most absent in its use. That means us lot. Then there's the materiality-based reporting, where the driving organizing principle is what's important. And so the whole conversation becomes, what do we mean by important? Yeah, and that has both a narrowing effect and a deepening effect. The narrowing effect is it means that a whole bunch of stuff doesn't get reported because some accountant, auditor, or business manager, for good, bad, or medium reasons, deems it immaterial. So, for example, Nike cannot persuade their general counsel, risk manager, and head of investor relations that labor standards is material to their future business performance. They simply cannot persuade them. Why? Because in 10 years of campaigning, there are only two instances of a mainstream investor ever picking up the phone to ask the head of investor relations anything about it at all. Yeah, so actually, that's why. But remember, those fund managers are churning their shares every 3 months. They're not hanging around at all. They're not interested in the future of Nike anyway. And so materiality is being driven by a short-term view within the financial market that actually has nothing to do with the materiality of business strategy and performance, but has to do with the incentive structure of the 24-year-old down the road. So materiality isn't a choice between financial and non-financial, but becomes completely geared by short-term investment incentives, quite inappropriately structured within the investment community. What does that mean for the OFR, the Operating and Financial Review? It means that there will be an overwhelming push by auditors and lawyers to make it completely irrelevant. And probably they'll win. Its inner structure allows for it to have real value. Value within companies and value to both financial and non-financially concerned stakeholders. That a materiality-based approach is the way to go. There's no question about it at all. But the combination of vested interests and structured incentives that I've described is most likely to drive OFR to irrelevance. The response from the NGO community, and indeed from some progressive businesses, is equally idiotic, which is they're saying, in that case, if it's going to be irrelevant, we'll drive for mandatory disclosure on a number of topics, back to broad-based reporting, yeah, whereupon they get their checklist if they win the day on the law, but the data is also irrelevant and no one's going to use it. Yeah, so this is not going to deliver the solutions. At the same time, and I'll stop after that, what we are finding is that both aspects of broadband reporting and increasingly materiality-based reporting is driving significant learning within companies. And so we're seeing, you know, if I was having to make a number, I'd say 80% of the effect is before it hits the light, and very little of the effect externally. And for 2 or 3 or 4 years, that's incredibly useful. The problem is that you get a declining use because there's a declining threat, because they realize that nobody's reading the damn stuff. But for a period of time, it drives significant learning inside companies, but certainly not for the longer term.
Thanks very much. Very interesting lecture. I'm Tim Foxham from Imperial College. I wanted to ask, come back to this point about the lessons for the academic community. The lessons for the academic community, particularly on the research side as well as the teaching side. Given the sort of the silo mentality that's still quite prevalent within the academic community, the difficulty of communicating between academic departments as well as communicating within different institutions. I mean, how does the academic community positively engage with this sort of very exciting agenda that you've raised tonight? I know there's probably a whole new.
I ask me. Well, let me be selfish. Yeah. Come and work with us a bit more. What do I mean? I mean that there remains a silo between the academic and the applied research establishment, and this is a big problem, because the academic research establishment has some very useful methodological tricks, has ways of thinking about research processes that we can't hope to emulate in what are near-market research organizations like us. But on the other side, we don't look at companies as cases. We work with them for years. Yeah, so that we have a completely different mental model and a completely different set of experiences that we do codify, but we codify in a different way. What we tend to be good at is seed research, first in, different way of thinking about things. And a lot of the work that I've talked about that Accountability has done is very much a kind of first generation work, which then actually isn't picked up terribly well. Yeah, and it isn't picked up because it's a relay race model. So yesterday I was sitting with a group of people from a bunch of Italian universities wanting to do a whole lot of work on responsible competitiveness. But it's a sort of a relay race model. So we've done our bit. Thank you very much. Now we know the method. They'll do they'll do the next bit with a set of traditional academic tools and processes. And that's completely the wrong way of thinking about methodological innovation. Yeah, what needs to happen is you need to work with us on the first stage and we need to work with you on the second stage. Yeah, and there needs to be much, much more of that. Your problem is you've got to publish. Yeah, and the stuff we produce is almost unpublishable. But certainly really hard to publish in Class A journals. Yeah, but actually we know this story, which is we have to create new generations of Class A journals. We know this from the participative area. We know this from all sorts of other generations of knowledge that was discredited within the academic community, and you had to punch bag for 10 years before anybody took notice. And it's the same space. Yeah, and so the answer is not for you to go, we've got to publish in grade A, so we can't work with you because you don't do grade A, Simon. That's really not the right solution. Yeah, it's the opposite, which is you've got to work with us, we've got to work with you, and we've got to create a new generation of academic outputs.
Up in the balcony.
Hi.
Corporate responsibility has often been accused of being a business fad. What do you think is the biggest threat to making it a fad?
What's the biggest threat to...
If they're saying it's just going to be a fad, what factors do you think will contribute it to being a fad and not being long-term?
So it is a fad. So let's start with the facts, yeah? But that doesn't mean that as the crappy bits fall away, it doesn't leave something interesting behind. When you talk to people, not me, because I wasn't around, that were part of the transmission of the environmental movement into a series of professions dealing with environmental management systems and all sorts of eco-efficiency stuff at the end of the 80s. Yeah, and then you had the recession and a whole lot went bust. And then out of the early 90s came some of the more kind of robust and durable processes and experiences that the business community and others have managed to take on. So part of the answer is fashionability in and of itself can be a useful catalyzing process. And a lot of it will fall away. You know, of the 8 zillion codes that are out there at the moment dealing with labour standards, 8 zillion minus 8 zillion plus one will survive in 5 years. Most of it will just go bust. And most of the organisations, probably including accountability, won't be around in a few years. Yeah, because we're part of a sort of an initiating process. Yeah, that's okay. I think one should feel bad about fads and fashions would be my first take. But then the question is, how do you make sure something important stays behind? And that, to me, seems really key. And part of the answer, I think, is about market dynamics, which is why all of us are so obsessed about the business case. Yeah, which is, if it doesn't deliver to individual companies, and if those individual companies are not powerful enough to be part of the process of reshaping tomorrow's markets, it's history. Yeah, and not a very interesting history. That corporate responsibility is like the other half of the anti-globalization movement. They're both saying the same thing, in a way. It's just that if you look at the corporate responsibility space, the opportunity is to reshape markets. And if we don't manage to reshape international markets along the contours of social and environmental responsibility, only exceptional companies will be able to be different. And the rest will just follow the pathway of often quite disreputable but normal behavior. Yeah. So reshaping markets becomes key. But reshaping markets is partly about product and business innovation. It's partly about regulation. And it's partly about us, customers, employees, and all that stuff, about what we do when we interface with the market. I think during the 90s, I spent a number of years working as a freelancer. Because most of that work was working with individual companies. And I did that, A, because it was a good laugh, but B, because I felt that during that period, the key was to show that individual companies could kind of do it. They could innovate. And so working with one-off leadership companies seems to me the key thing to do. Yeah, I think we're in a slightly different phase now. Yeah, and I think we're now looking at structure. Yeah, we're now looking at new types of institutions. We're now looking at new types of regulatory models. I think this decade will be about moving from the exceptional to the mundane. Yeah, that we've got to, this stuff's got to stop being exceptional. It's got to be boring. Yeah, which I know is a bit of an odd way of looking at it, but it's true. As long as it's exceptional, it's at risk. Yeah, we have to be able to translate it out of the weirdos and weirdo organizations like accountability into kind of normal, pedestrian, boring organizations that do things at scale. Yeah, and I think this period is about that. Both within organisations, which was Andrew's point. It's not about the corporate responsibility department. It's about how that links to corporate governance, general counsel, marketing, and so on. It's getting rid of the weirdness and beginning to embed. And the same at a kind of meta level, the structures of institutions.
I know a lot of people want to ask questions, but I think I'm going to have to draw it to close. There is a reception after this to which everyone is invited in the Shaw Library on the fifth floor of our building. I'm sure Simon will be willing to answer some questions.
Yeah, no, I'm going to hang out.
But to close the proceedings, I'm going to call across on Professor Hankin from Imperial College.
Good evening. Thank you very much. I just have a few words to say. I won't hold us back from the reception for too long. But First of all, on behalf of Imperial College, I'd like to thank the LSE for organising the lecture this evening, and particularly to you, Yvonne, and Henrietta, for hosting this evening's meeting. I think it's very important to hold such events, as these bring together our institutions in common areas of teaching and research, and it's great to see the seminar series, which was kicked off a couple of years ago, continuing in such an exciting fashion this evening. I know that both the Centre for Environmental Policy and Governance at the LSE and the Department of Environmental Science and Technology at Imperial have a high level of expertise in research in what is really one of the most important issues facing the world today. And it's essential that we're able to work together to achieve common goals, which will be of immense importance both to us and to the generations which follow us. I'm particularly pleased to be able to thank Simon tonight for a very interesting presentation, and I'm thrilled you agreed to give this what my advisors have called an inaugural lecture, but I think I like to think of it as a restarting sort of lecture, so a re-inauguration of this series. And what I'd like to do really is finish by advertising future events in this series, and in particular the next one, which will be hosted at Imperial. We're pleased to say that Professor Jim Ski, who's Research Director of the UK Energy Research Centre and a visiting professor in our Department of Environmental Science and Technology, has agreed to give the next lecture, the second lecture in this particular part of the series. And this will be at some date in the autumn, which is yet to be agreed, but will be communicated to you in due course. UK Energy Research Centre's headquarters is now in Exhibition Road, just opposite Imperial College, and its technology and policy assessment function is led by Robert Gross of the Department of Environmental Science and Technology. We've also got involvement in one of the research themes, the Materials for Advanced Energy Systems, which is led by one of the co-directors of the Energy Research Centre, Professor John Kilner, of the Department of Materials. So we look forward to seeing many of you again in the autumn to listen to Professor Ski's lecture on energy and environment, and we'll look forward to welcoming many colleagues from LSE to that event. So let me just reiterate my thanks once again to you, Simon, and wish you all a pleasant evening. I think that should start with the reception that Yvonne advertised, if you notice.